of the world because it just hasn't been right in front of their face like it has in the case of the rest of the world. What are the drivers? The drivers are really local markets. And there is a cost to transportation of modules. They're pretty heavy, and you want to be close to the markets. And the other driver is incentives for factories. Now, of course, if there was a level playing field and there were no unequal incentives, that would be irrelevant. Low cost of doing business would, of course, be critical. So if it comes out that the cost of doing business is worse because of your tax structures and your employment structures and your medical costs, et cetera, then, of course, you're not going to have manufacturing. But that's a general problem. But some things do favor the U.S. Capable workforce, safe environment for workers, a reliable national legal system. That's a nice thing to have. Wouldn't it be nice to have a little bit of definition of what that is these days, but presumably it does exist, and low cost of energy. And those things do exist in the United States, or at least regionally. And it's my belief that there is no issue about manufacturing in the United States that having a market in the United States wouldn't solve. So then the question is, where do we stand competitively? I mean, after all, the question is, would U.S. companies have a role in manufacturing wherever they would be? So that's a really good question. So that's what a lot of the rest of the talk is about. And it's also about the cost of PV. And it's the cost of PV in a context that probably matters more than anything else, and that's the non-CO2 sources of energy. And that's wind, CSP, nuclear, and maybe the fantasy of carbon sequestration. So among those, where is PV in terms of its cost? That's important, because right now PV is more costly than wind and about the same as concentrating solar power. So its competitive position is very important. There are a number of technologies in PV, and interestingly enough, perhaps due to the government policy, the United States has somebody in the leadership role in each technology. In crystalline silicon, in cadmium telluride, in thin film or amorphous silicon, in copper-neodymium diselenide, the big four, we have somebody who can be a leader in the world in terms of technology. No other place on Earth has that. Most places, and some places like China, have very little besides crystalline silicon. We have a few good companies. We might have a few good men in the Marines, and we have a few good companies in photovoltaics. But the companies manufacture the modules, and the modules are the heart of photovoltaics. That's where all the intellectual property is. That's where you have 20 years of technological leadership if you have the best in the world, and nobody else can even come close to competing with you. Now, there's been a lot of progress in the last few years in terms of U.S. manufacturing. And what has happened is that thin films have come pretty much out of nowhere to start taking a bigger role than they had before. And First Solar, which was on the podium this morning, and unfortunately, as I said, I had to give a talk this morning, and I was unable to be here for that talk, has come from no production in 2004 to be the second largest PV company in the world during that time. And they're an innovative thin film company in cadmium telluride. So this is an example of how disruptive leadership technologies in the United States that really came out of the U.S. DOE program in terms of supporting innovation in technology have a major role in today's photovoltaics. And SunPower is another great company in terms of its technology and its technology leadership. And I believe that I have United Solar on the next list as the second largest U.S. manufacturer and projected to be the largest in, it says here 08. So this could be an 07. Well, wait a second. Okay, there's some kind of disconnect here, but it looks like United Solar would be the largest on the current basis of current plans if First Solar doesn't build more factories in the United States. Bear in mind, First Solar is at 500 megawatts, moving to 1,000 megawatts this year with existing production, but a lot of that is in Malaysia and Germany with only 150 megawatts here in Ohio in the United States. They did start in Ohio. But again, as I said, there's no reason they wouldn't expand here or in Arizona or wherever to meet demand if the demand was here. And there are reasons why these companies are here. And the reasons are, first of all, that their technology was developed here. Second of all, that Michigan gave incentives. Third of all, when you have an innovative technology, you need to keep your researchers and scientific staff close to the manufacturers the first time you scale up. So the first factories were always built here because it was too risky to send the first factories abroad. Later factories were sent abroad by First Solar. So the U.S. position in technology is the U.S. dominates CAD telluride, and CAD telluride right now is the lowest cost PV technology for large systems, any system above, say, a residential size. It's clearly the lowest cost. No one dominates the copper-neodymium diselenide area because it's a newer, innovative technology where no one has really made the turn in terms of reaching economies of scale, such as for solar has reached. But it's expected to be competitive with cadmium telluride. The first one to really make a big announcement is Showa Shell, a Japanese company, which has announced a 1 gigawatt manufacturing facility for a year from now. So we'll find out a lot more in a year whether or not the CIS can bring together its great efficiency with its difficulty of manufacturing to reach a product that is competitive. The U.S. is good is thin in crystalline silicon, with only SunPower and Advent and Evergreen as representatives. But SunPower is certainly an excellent company. And the U.S. is definitely in the hunt in terms of thin film and amorphous silicon, where I would say United Solar is still the best thin film amorphous silicon company in the world. Perhaps Sharp is in a similar role, but a very different product, a glass amorphous silicon instead of a flexible one. And Applied Materials makes equipment. So past technology funding, this is where I get to the part that's interesting about the government, defines today's technological landscape in photovoltaics. And I've already said that past market incentives defines where the companies manufacture and where they install. This is what I'm saying. Government policy has defined the landscape of photovoltaics. It really isn't much of a leap. Photovoltaics is not a cost-competitive technology. It is a societal contract with manufacturers and technologists and scientists to develop a non-CO2 source of energy and one that can diversify away from fossil fuels. Now, when we reach a cost competitiveness, that might change, but that's not the case yet. So the technology development in the United States emphasized thin films, and among the thin films was interested in cadmium telluride, and that's why the United States is a leader in thin films and cadmium telluride. Most other nations emphasize crystalline silicon and thin film silicon, and the United States is competitive there, but not a leader there. So every region can be very clearly defined by what its government technology development program emphasized or left out. And that's what I'm saying here, is that the technology policy of the government defined the technology position landscape, and the market policy defined the installations. So what is module technology development based on? We're talking about manufacturing programs here. The Thin Film Partnership, by the way, did everything from materials research through solar cells, through module development, process scale-up, pilot production, and first-time manufacturing. So we had some sense of all the different things that go into a module manufacturing program. So it's applied research and manufacturing. It's applied research because you need to understand what these complex, almost infinitely complex semiconductors are like, especially in manufacturing, but also in solar cell design, because solar cells are really, really strange. You can make them very similarly, and they can be terrible to the ones that are great. You have to have some subtle sense of how those solar cells are made in order to make them successfully. That's why a solar cell scientist these days can walk out the door at Enroll and earn $1 million or more in stock, because they can start a new PV company. And you can't start a manufacturing company except with that expertise. Anyone on the planet can start an installation company or a financial incentives company, but very few people, a handful, can make these new manufacturing companies work. We couldn't afford a good deal of cell R&D before that we can now. I mean, we're talking about the DOE program having major increases coming with the Obama administration. Let me recall what we did and didn't do during a time when the Thin Film Partnership had the major portion of money for cadmium telluride, technology that First Solar represented here in the morning as a billion-dollar business and the lowest-cost technology in the world, we had $5 million a year. Of course, we had it for 25 years, and people did complain it took a long time. Of course, if they had given us a little more during that time, maybe it wouldn't have taken so long. But in any case, what we didn't get a chance to do was tame the complexity of those semiconductors, because we did one-of-a-kind kind of experiments. We'd make a small area cell, we'd make three of them, turn the machine off, come back to it a week later, try it again, the machine didn't work. I mean, it's basically irreproducible results where you follow the best thing that you can do intuitively towards a better and better result. So we never spent a lot of money on doing combinatorial research on high volume throughput of semiconductors. Having spent a little time subsequently in a startup company, I know we did in 1 week more samples than NREL did in a year, because we had machines that were able to make this big and this big. And that's the thing that DOE has never done. It's never asked its research community, whether it's universities or NREL, to process large areas, large amounts, repeatedly to get statistics, but also to put the throughput in to do successful combinatorial research. The kind of progress we could make in a month on those kind of samples was, it made me sick to think how hard it was to do that on the small area samples that we used to do. So this is where I remind us that, in fact, this hasn't been done before. We haven't had a robust thin film program. We haven't had a robust silicon program. We haven't had a robust crystalline silicon program. We've never had a robust R&D program in PV. We had pathetic shoestring programs that, because of the dedication of the people involved and the value of what they were doing, succeeded. First-time manufacturing is a very important challenge. And for a lot of these technologies where they don't have as much fundamental knowledge as it would be good to have, first-time manufacturing is still a time of very great risk. In fact, for some of the new technologies like CIS haven't quite made it into successful commercial level yet. It's because they're still fighting the first-time manufacturing problem. But it doesn't mean they're not worthy technologies. CIS makes 20% small area solar cells. Just means it's a harder technology and needs more time and patience. Never forget the complex feedback loop. Yes, you're trying to increase efficiency, but you're also trying to reduce area cost. You're trying to raise throughput. You're trying to change you're making device refinements while you're manufacturing. You're simplifying the process to bring down the cost of manufacturing while you're still trying to get high efficiency. You're increasing the area in your machine while you're trying to get high throughput, because machine costs go up with the log of the width. You're checking and rechecking the stability of your semiconductor layers. Semiconductor photovoltaics is hard. It's excruciatingly hard. And one of the things that happens in places like Washington, where I wasn't for 26 years, is they don't realize how hard it is. They don't understand what's going on with their money. And so if they spend 25 years at $5 million a year, they get impatient. Technologies are not alike. When we talk about a manufacturing program, you have to tailor your activities for each technology. Something like crystalline silicon doesn't need as much fundamental foundational knowledge as something like CIGS, where you don't even know how to put copper, indium, gallium, sulfur, and selenium together to make a 20% solar cell repeatedly. So you have to do a lot more foundational research there. CAD telluride is closer to that. It also has a great number of unresolved problems at the foundational level. So what you want to do is do everything that needs to be done on that path, that critical path, to make those technologies successful. Things I also recall that worked were knowing that cells and modules are the driver of photovoltaics, that continuity of research matters instead of jumping from one thing to another, the thin film partnership approach instead of DARPA approach, the complementary competencies matter, that you have different talents working on the same thing, that you fund dynamic companies, usually one product companies, because their survival depends on it, and not oil companies and conglomerates where people, if they're really sincere, are still trying to get the attention of upper management or middle management, and next time there's a change in management, they may disappear. Who are the leaders in the United States? SunPower, Unisolar, and First Solar, all one product companies. Fund your research one step ahead of where their comfort zone is. They will take your money to do the research they do anyway, yes. But if you ask them to do something a little harder than they would have done, then the research director is thrilled. And the manager above them says, that's cost sharing, I can do that. And you get a little bit more than you would otherwise. And by the way, you drive the future of the technology because you're funding the best companies for a little better than they could do otherwise. What not to do? Overhead will be absorbed by volume. You don't need to do this. The company managers do this for a living. And this is my next to last slide. Include a process for differences of opinion. I read a recent article about how they learned to have pilots be able to talk to each other without hierarchical barriers in order to avoid disasters. And it brought down the number of crashes, of airplane crashes in the United States by 40%. It's very difficult in these hierarchical organizations, and government is the most hierarchical because, after all, what else is there but territory and government? And so to be able to deal with differences of opinion, to have the new opinions be able to be heard, to be able to honestly evaluate those opinions and learn from those opinions to do better than you used to do would be a great thing and actually could be institutionalized. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ken. Chuck, we have time to do questions after each speaker. Is that what we're doing, or you want to?
Could I suggest we push on?
We'll push on, and then we'll hold them to the end.
Yes.
Thank you. Steve, floor is yours.
Good afternoon. I suppose I have the distinct challenge this afternoon of following a rather distinguished lineup of presenters throughout the day, but also of following lunch. So I'll do my best to make sure that we can all stay awake as best I can here. I like to think that if we can distill an issue down to a math problem, we can define a solution. Now, the solution might be unpalatable, and if we find that that's the case, what it means is we've defined boundary conditions which we can try and work within. In the next 15 minutes, what I'm going to try to do is precisely that for the solar PV industry, at the manufacturing level and then at the market level for installations. And I'm going to do this from a financing perspective. So, first, let's look at a snapshot of the industry. Solar PV levelized cost of electricity, what companies do, is declining. It's coming down probably more rapidly than most people thought it would, to the credit of the companies that are driving this technology. What's also happening, and what we can be relatively confident in, is that the cost of grid-supplied electricity is going up. All that means is if we're here, that gap is the problem. That gap means we have to fund that gap in order to make it competitive. If we don't fund it, it doesn't happen. What happens next is an industry does what an industry will do. Supply and demand. We're in a situation now where we have oversupply. It's kind of annoying, and it's going to last for a few years. If you look at this as a snapshot for the industry, we have three fundamental challenges from a financing perspective. First, we need to clean up an industry in overcapacity. That's going to happen in due course, but I can almost guarantee it's going to happen more slowly than all of us in this room would like. Second, we need to finance a capacity base for future growth. Lastly, we need to finance the growth, which is the installations, driving the market overall. These years in here are all about positioning this industry. We have a choice to do it here. It's being done elsewhere. It's being done in Germany. It can be done here. It does require additional investment, and we'll talk about that for a minute. So I'm going to do three things now with respect to both manufacturing and also the market. I want to define the investment required. That's number one. Number two, I want to define the gap so that we can become competitive. both in manufacturing as well as installations. And then I want to suggest some means to close the gap. That's fundamentally what we need to do over the next several years. That has a lasting impact for the long term. And if we're right about what happens in this industry, demand will be enormous 5, 10, 15 years in the future. But it requires preparation now. So let's look at the solar PV value chain to start. Talked about this already. Crystalline silicon approaches, thin film approaches. Upstream is manufacturing, downstream is installations. If you parse this, upstream here, polysilicon, precursors for polysilicon. This is a manufacturing industry that has long since been established in this country. This country has done a remarkable job of keeping it here, and it's not going away. This percentage of the industry declines because of growth from incumbents elsewhere, not a whole bunch of upstarts out of China. Not too worried about that part of the industry. Second, we look at manufacturing in the U.S. for this portion of the value chain. Raw materials down to the modules, the energy generating asset. What's the problem here? We have very little manufacturing here. If we want to distill this down to a financial discussion, this migrates to where business models are optimized, where companies are most profitable. What is the single biggest issue when you do this analysis? And we'll step through it. It's taxes. Then you go downstream. We have a small market here in the U.S. If we define efficacy of incentive programs based upon the size of the market, we have a problem here. It's simply not doing what we would like it to do. It means it's not enough. We'll talk about that in a minute, too. But what this involves is overcoming several issues. And I'm going to talk about project side of things. What does it take to install a project and make it move forward? It requires several things. Project returns need to be adequate. Cash flows need to work. And risks need to be accommodated. If you can't accommodate all three of those things, a project does not move forward. So let's start with manufacturing. If you look at this chart, this is my assessment. These are my numbers of a manufacturing industry being built in the U.S. over the course of the next 20 years. Not the U.S., I'm sorry, globally. Within this, the single biggest year of installation of capacity is 22 gigawatts. The total installed capacity 20 years or thereabouts from now is over 200 gigawatts. With that, we will end up with about 4.5% of electricity generated from solar PV on a global basis. Now, let's look at the investment required to put this in place. If you look at a cost per watt for installations, that is, what does it cost to put manufacturing in place so you can build all this stuff? These are simply boundary conditions. This is a forecast. What does that tell us? What we need to spend over the course of the next 15 years to put this in place is upwards of $100 billion. What we need to spend over the course of the next 20 years to put this manufacturing in place is upwards of $150 billion. This, for example, is capital spending. This is equipment spending. These are meaningful markets. The question is where they end up. If that's manufacturing, what's the problem? Now we quantify the gap, since we've quantified what the opportunity is. If you look at a U.S. manufacturer, for example, and incidentally, all these numbers are mine, some of the structures that you see here, operating structures, may mirror some companies in the industry, but the numbers are not those companies' numbers. They're simply mine for the purposes of argument. That being the case, if you have a manufacturing profile predominantly Asia, some U.S., some Germany, 2011, let's take some of that manufacturing from Asia and let's move it to the U.S. What happens? Net margins, profitability of the company comes down, and it comes down by a meaningful amount. What's the predominant impact? It's taxes. What does it do to profitability? It reduces it by 14%. That is a vexing problem. That's the biggest issue to resolve from a financial perspective when you think about where companies will site manufacturing. Look at another example in the U.S. Very different operating structure for the company. An awful lot of revenue comes from the U.S., but it's not manufacturing. Similar situation. Take some of Asia, move it to the U.S., not a huge amount. Net margins are impacted. Taxes are the primary input. 4% reduction in net profitability. That's meaningful. This is almost insurmountable. In order to accommodate this with taxes alone, you need less than 10% from what is now a corporate tax rate of 35%. One more thing. Let's look at China. Let's take a Chinese manufacturer now, and now we have a bigger problem. Because in China, what we deal with are companies that have very low costs of capital, 3.5% on average, and they get tax credits. They don't pay tax. If that's the case, it's a very difficult situation to resolve. And if we go through the same exercise, because earnings are low, this looks much more pronounced. The problem is, you can look at Germany as well, go through the same exercise, declines in net margin, taxes are the primary impact, you get a reduction in earnings. What happens? You need a negative tax rate to make this work in the U.S. All things being equal, that's the problem. That's the quantified issue, and now we have to surmount it. How do you do that? Take the worst-case scenario, the first one I showed. Move things to the U.S. We understand what the impact is. Now look at what you can do about it. These are incentives. Look at a modestly lower tax rate. This has duration. That's the frustration. It could last a while. That can account for about a third of it. Consider something like a manufacturing credit. 27 cents per watt for what's manufactured in the U.S., not a production credit for cost per kilo or for kilowatt hours, but for manufacturing. Then take a look at capital spending subsidy, like they do in Germany. This is an example of what can be done with direct incentives to resolve a very difficult issue predominantly driven by taxes that impacts profitability of companies. When management teams make decisions on where they site manufacturing, a lot of it is with respect to the fiduciary responsibility they have to shareholders. That being the case, all risks being accounted for, if you have a gap of 14% in profitability, the decision is clear. So, what else do we need to consider in manufacturing? Indirect impacts. I cannot emphasize enough, it's been said over and over today, if we had a market in this country that was rapidly growing, it would draw manufacturing. Would it be 70% of a manufacturing base? No, it would not. But rather than having 5% of a manufacturing base on a global basis, we could have 20. I think it's unrealistic to think we'd have 50% or more. So that said, I want to step into the energy side of things. Again, we're going to quantify what needs to be done. If this initial assessment forecast that I put up is true, what needs to be financed on an annual basis over the course of the next 15 or 20 years? We have a $50 billion industry growing to $150 billion a year. Those are big numbers. Those numbers require forms of financing that don't exist in this industry yet today. 15 years out, I'm not worried about. What I'm more worried about now is the near term and how we overcome some of the issues associated with it. So, think about the gap. The way we like to look at things is a levelized cost of electricity. Look at a simple system, crystalline silicon, installed in a high sunlight region today. Call it 550 a watt, we get a levelized cost of electricity. Include the benefit of the ITC or the grant. Include the benefit of accelerated depreciation. Now include some nominal state incentives to bring down a levelized cost of electricity. Now look at the competition. Wind, combined cycle natural gas, peaking power plants. What you can compete with, arguably, are peaking power plants, all very well and good. In order to get explosive growth in an industry, we need to be down here. So, when we talk about closing this gap, there are many ways to do it. I'm going to translate this now to a financial discussion where rather than talking about levelized cost of electricity, I'm going to talk about project returns. A project gets installed, there are several things that need to be met before it goes forward. So, if you look at project ROIs, return on investment, that is the return to investors for putting a project in place, I'm going to assume a 1 megawatt system, I'm going to assume the middle of the country. There are a bunch of things that we consider, and this is a fairly complex analysis for a power purchase agreement, long-term energy agreement. If we look at today, no incentives, what's the project return? It's minus 20%. That tells you something. We need incentives. So what happens? If you take a look at a baseline number, And what I'm going to call baseline is the existing incentives today to take you to a 6% return on the project. What's a target? Let's call it 10%. Germany's around 8% right now with some growth in the industry. If we look at single solutions on the two most important variables, system price and the cost of capital, what's required to meet that? You have to cut the system price in half, or you have to provide essentially free money. It's a difficult thing to overcome in the near term. So now let's think about some single point alternatives. What are these? Feed-in tariffs have been shown to grow industries quite effectively. They're simple, they're easily understood, and they're easily built into financing arrangements. That being the case, if we were to take a base case and supplement it with a feed-in tariff on top of what would be being paid for that electricity under a power purchase agreement, lo and behold, these numbers start to look like a feed-in tariff for Germany, maybe Spain. And now we have project ROIs that are similar to Germany or to Spain. If we were to look at a different approach, and this one I don't think is in effect anywhere, where you look at the cash flows of this project over the course of 20 years, add up all the positive cash flows in the out years, because that's when it's positive, and give an upfront grant at a certain percentage of those cash flows, it requires a significant upfront investment to bring it to a reasonable ROI, a reasonable return. One other thing. Let's look at a sensitivity to base case. Again, ASP of the system, cost of capital. System prices change and cost of capital changes, significant changes in the project returns. All this stuff needs to be done on a case-by-case basis. So understanding this sensitivity, we can then take a look at alternative solutions, which are supplemental to base case. You can look at an additional grant. You can look at lowering the cost of capital. You can look at an additional feed-in tariff or an upfront profit match. These are incremental potential solutions to solve the project return issue. The first issue to resolve is that. It's solving the return issue. If the return does not meet a threshold, investors walk away and the project doesn't happen. It's as simple as that. Now, what's the next issue that needs to be resolved to make sure a project moves forward? It's all about cash flows. The other issue, the big issue that makes investors walk away from a project, is that the out-of-pocket money is much too high up front. How do you solve these problems? Well, let's think about this for a minute. We have an instance now where 30% grant goes to fund a system. That leaves 70% of a system funding required. If you can't get that funding, and it's somewhat difficult these days to do that with a credit freeze, the project doesn't move forward. Is there a way to eliminate an upfront cash outflow for the project owner, maintain the project ROI, the project return, and very importantly, maintain the same net outflow of cash from the government over a 20-year term? The answer is yes, but it's difficult to do. If you look at this, what it means is that you'll be doing a 30% upfront grant, as we know, and you will get 35 plus 35% or 70% in additional funding that flows from the government to some sort of a government-sponsored entity. It can be a no-interest loan. That then gets funded for the project, and then the project owner pays back interest on the entire system price. What it does is it lowers the near-term return on the project from 6 to 2%, but still provides you with an 8.5% return on a 30-year useful life. Is it perfect? No. But what we have now is solved the project return issue, and we've solved the cash flow mismatch issue. What's left? One more thing, too, actually, tends to derail projects early on. The primary risk issues. The first is stranded assets. What's a stranded asset? You put a 1-megawatt system on a building. The tenant of that building, who happens to be paying for that electricity under an agreement, disappears. Now you have an asset that is still fine, generating electricity, and no one to pay for the energy. That destroys your project return. It destroys your cash flows. Now, one thing I will say is there are two counterparties to this. First counterparty is he who pays for the electricity. Second counterparty is the sun. The sun's been pretty reliable as a counterparty for a long, long time and probably will remain so. At least that's my guess. If that's the case, what you have is an asset that continues to generate what it's supposed to generate, that has value. If you think about a house and a mortgage, when a tenant defaults or a mortgage owner defaults, that house effectively doesn't have value to the owner of the mortgage because it doesn't generate an output that can be monetized. This asset continues to generate an output that can be monetized. So what do? You can do something like create an account. Now, would it come originally from the GSE? Possibly. Would it then be funded and owned by the utilities, for example, maybe on a rate adjustment? We'll see how big it needs to be. And what it would allow is in the event of a customer default, you still have good energy, you would sell it back to the utility through the grid, the utility would compensate you for that, and you have 2 years in order to repurpose that asset, find a new tenant, remove the asset, and use it elsewhere. It's a possibility to solve that stranded asset risk issue. There are other approaches as well. What's another issue? Technology risk. New technology risk. Very high risk premiums on the cost of capital will prevent new technology projects from moving forward. It's as simple as that. What can you do? You can guarantee warranties. That's costly. Probably not something you really want to do. What else can you do? You can create an insurance product. What does an insurance product do? It will compensate the owner of the project by giving them a higher return in order to retain the risk that the technology may fail. How much does that need to be? Maybe a few full points, and that's expensive. How do you price something like that? I'm not sure yet, but it's something we'll take a look at. So all that said, when you think about a project and you think about growing the market, structured finance will solve the ROI issue. It will solve the cash flow issue. It can solve the primary risks issue. Lastly, what do you want to do? You want to affect a structure that allows the public sector to offload all of this to the private sector over time. The stewardship of this project begins with the government, and then the government needs to offload it. How do you do that? Who are the intermediaries? The banks. The banks are those. What do they look for? They look for low costs of capital with the ability to lend it out at a higher cost of capital. You begin the process by doing precisely that with things coming from the GSE to the banks. It creates liquidity through leverage, and it provides you with a reasonable return on your investment. Then what's required is a mandated sale of those assets to private investors. If that happens, they're purchased on leverage, and returns are more than reasonable. This is the first step in securitization, meaning you draw the private sector in to the industry to finance the industry. What happens over time? Eventually, banks assume the responsibility for loan origination. The stewardship of this industry shifts from the government to the private sector, and you have a self-sustaining industry. This process takes years. Can it be done and put in place now for effect over the next several years? It can. What does it require? It requires more money up front. It's as simple as that. Now, that money can be recouped over a 20-year term, but this is a structure that can work in structured finance to make things work for projects and grow a market. All that said, when you think about wrapping all of this up, things need to be resolved in manufacturing along the lines of profitability. That's a tax issue. Another way of driving manufacturing, albeit less pronounced, is by building the market here. We can build the market here, but it requires greater upfront priming of the pump from the government, which means money. And it's such an arrangement that I kind of tried to describe there as best I could to be able to do that. Now, last thing I will say is I've spent the last 15 minutes or so talking about solar PV in isolation and the financing of solar PV as a point solution. My inclination is to believe, in fact, I'm quite certain, that over the next several years, maybe a little bit longer, solar PV is not going to be viewed and shouldn't be viewed as a point solution for energy generation. We have to look at overall renewable energy generation solutions, of which solar PV is a part. And now I'll step back from the quantitative part and say something qualitative. I would be willing to bet that the returns on renewable energy solutions overall are going to be better than most people think when we really start to do the math over the course of the next couple of few years and put it all together and understand what the benefits are. But that's a whole different discussion.
And I'll leave it at that.
I have a question, but I'm going to hold it till the end. Norman?
Thank you. I've been asked to talk a little bit about the solar industry in Northwest Ohio. It's been going on for quite some time, but it really got started in 2003 with several of us getting together and talking about what could happen in Northwest Ohio. Steve just talked about all the money that's been distributed. People in Northwest Ohio knew the automotive industry was going to go belly up years ago. I've been in it, ran one of their major plastic suppliers. It's a bit like dating a vampire. The people that did this are major companies, and certainly in conjunction with the University of Toledo. One of the guys who helped start that is here today, Frank Calzinetti. Somebody said the light bulb went on. For us, it went off. In August of 2003, Ohio was blamed for a $1 billion or $2 billion power outage, which goes to your comment about there's a lot of other costs that never get quantified. And it was said that if we'd have had a few solar fields in Ohio, that wouldn't have happened. So we decided to capitalize in our history in Northwest Ohio and go look at using alternative energy, and particularly solar, to sort of save the day for Toledo. And while there's been a lot of talk about this, Harold McMaster, I think, who died in early 2003, was really the founder of this. And he and his friends from the period of 1984 to 2003 probably spent $50 million in this industry trying to get it going. It was a good thing. Harold made $500 million in the glass industry before he got into this as a hobby. He started at GlassTech Solar. Solar Cells was started at the University of Toledo. And by starting solar cells at the University of Toledo, it led to the foundation of a large number of people coming in that are well-recognized in the industry. Al Capone, I think, was the first one. Xinmin Ding came in and then left to start his own solar company. Rob Collins, who was at Penn State and worked with BP for 15 years, showed up in Toledo. And as we got more grants, we now have Mike Hebron coming in from such elite places as NREL. So after spending $50 million in a lot of development, Harold never quite got there. Solar Cells spun off First Solar, and that's a euphemism, by a lot of other people coming in, spending $50 to $100 million to get First Solar going, and he no longer had any affiliation. Still not done with his hobby, he founded in 2003 Solar Fields, which I'm affiliated with. But because of the work he did at UT, the UT funding was level for quite some time till all the business leaders got together and went to Columbus, who amazingly had not heard of any of this, and said, you guys are missing a bet. And with a great program put together by Rob Collins, we were able to get the PVAC Wright Center for about $18 million, and now the amount of funding that is there is approaching $50 million. So we have a fantastic technical base in Toledo, Ohio, not only for CadTel, but for a number of other programs. And it's a good thing we do, because if you look at electric costs in northern Ohio, they average about 12.8. Electric costs have gone up 7% per year, which means we're going to be facing electric costs at about 50 cents, and as we've heard, sand and wind are going to cost pretty much the same in 2027. Anything else can't say the same. Energy sources, this has been talked about. I always find it interesting that coal and natural gas plants are only 33 to 45% effective, and these turbos that what we just talked about really gives you 80% of all the new electricity. So that peak power really is expensive. NOAA morphed into OAE. OAE is a statewide group of people that are interested in all forms of alternative energy. And that is represented by Terrence O'Donnell. If you have any questions about this kind of thing, stand up, Terrence, so people can see who you are. He'll be here later at the cocktail hour, but a good organization. Northwest Ohio has more CadTel experience, which is interesting because it is the least expensive way to make solar modules, according to all of these sources, than anywhere. And it was once known as the glass city. We're sort of working on it becoming the solar city. So we think this is a good way to go, as Mike Ahern and others have said. We're all building the same stack. The stack isn't patented. The way you get there, the road, is the way to go. In solar fields, it took us about 30 minutes for some of us that had been in the glass industry for 15 years to get around every one of First Solar's patents by coming up with a new way to put it down. Mike, are you still here? This little thing is our device. This is an atmospheric generator. This is a 4-inch square piece of glass on a benchtop at the University of Toledo. You drag it in, you coat it, you have a small solar panel. I've been in manufacturing for years. That didn't do it for me. So instantly, by the next year, we had a full-scale manufacturing line, again at the University of Toledo, where we were looking at making panels. And we think, versus other CadTel approaches, lower capital, faster production, yada, 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 but this really is a continuous process. So this is set for 2 foot wide, but do you want it 4 foot long, 10 foot long? Just tell us what you want. So that worked out. We had to graduate from the University of Toledo because we had to make it longer and they didn't want me to knock out the walls. But here you are. So we have a tech glass invented in Toledo by Pilkington, actually, when I was there. And we put CAD sulfide down, CadTel, run it on down, and voila, solar modules. So what did we do at that time? Let's go back to that. Here we are. We had made solar modules. All of this was financed by private investors in the Toledo area, including me. We thought, well, here we are. Geez, we've got this interesting process. We can probably make modules cheaper than First Solar. Somebody ought to be interested in this. So we sent in some – who's here from DOE? We sent in some requests for funding from DOE. Didn't get a penny. Apparently, we were much better inventors and developers than we were grant writers, or we had never gotten any grants, and if you've never been in line, you don't get to there. So we went out and looked for investors. I have a whole closet full of Chinese gifts. We settled on Qcells, which, as you've seen, is the world's largest supplier of modules, and entered into first a licensing arrangement and then a joint venture with them. We built them a 4-foot-wide machine, so now you can make something the size of a piece of plywood and all the subsequent cost reductions with that. They sent over a 747. We sent it to them. The joint venture is called Calixo, and here is Building A. And this is in Solar Valley in Germany, where they have 4,000 employees making solar panels. And plus they're importing them from the U.S., as we've all heard. This is Building B, so the idea, just like everybody else, is cut and paste and send them where there's a market. Notice these are in Germany. And why did it all start in Germany? Well, here's the cost of electricity in 99, and when everybody talks about grid parity and with solar in Europe, no wonder. Look at their energy costs. Here's Japan, here's Germany, and here's ours in 99. So if you're interested in green as the color of cash, which I am, no wonder people didn't want to do anything. We were getting really cheap electricity. And it sure is, as several people said, isn't because of the solar amounts. I sort of modeled several cloudy Ohio cities versus Munich and Berlin, and it's better, as other speakers have said. Those of you that represent Congress, I would like to remind you that the sun shines in every community and congressional district. And if you don't have one of these in yours, well, then you should be doing something about that. And if you go from one coast to another, sunny L.A. here to cloudy Maine, you need 25% difference. So if you can get the cost where you want to be. And that's the problem. CadTel being the cheapest way, Toledo with the University of Toledo and other advances are driving that down. We could literally make a module in the morning, take it to UT, and as you all know, graduate students are nocturnal, at least I was when I was a graduate student. The next day we'd have back results. Where else in the world could you do that? And we have been lean manufactured to death in the Midwest. I mean, just literally by the automotive companies. So a good way to look at low costs. Our goal to go from being the Rust Belt to being the Renewable Belt. And everybody's shown one of these. Install cost versus time goes down. Depending on the size, it goes down. I'll tell you right now, the numbers that people are projecting of putting things in for $3.50 or $4 are absolutely true. In fact, Marcy, if she ever shows up, gave us several million dollars to prove that. And we put together a group, OAE, with UT to evaluate a solar kit. Just everything you need, we thought we could get it in Ohio. And we've started putting that in. And the idea to build at least one megawatt, simple design, low cost. You don't need to invent this thing over and over again. It's repetitious. We started in June of 08. This is what it looks like in good weather. As we went on, this is what it looks like. And it's still generating electricity on December the 6th in Toledo, Ohio. And this is at dusk. So it's there, and the installation costs are as advertised from other people. This is Senate Bill 221. Our group, with Terrence O'Donnell's help, championed a renewable energy standard for the state. Hasn't helped us at all. It even has penalties in it, that if you don't put in solar, you get fined. Haven't seen any action. Wonder why. So what it does is renewable energy, same, 25% by 2025. It has a solar carve-out. Half of it has to come from photovoltaic. Well, we're making all this photovoltaic in the state. Wouldn't it be nice to sell some there? I'm actually in the installation business as well. I am Mike Ahern's largest customer. He makes 191 megawatts in Perrysburg, Ohio. The largest installation in Ohio is 1 megawatt. Go figure. So somebody needs to put in 700 to 900 megawatts. We're surrounded by a bunch of them. So you could export this, or other people could do this. So there is a lot of potential out there. Why aren't they going in? We've got a lot of production. Right now, and I said expanding to 170, I think he's got his efficiency up by 1% because he's at 191. Xinmingding will start up slowly in 2009, and by 2010 will be around 100 megawatt. Calixto, our joint venture, is producing where there is a market. And would North America be next, up to somebody to do something? And we have yet another CadTel wannabe that's doing R&D. So it's sort of like Silicon Valley, only the CadTel flatlands of Toledo or something. Why do you want photovoltaic? Creates a lot of jobs. Look at this versus anything else. Wow, why do you want PV? Look at the business chain. Here's Pilkington, 10 million square foot of glass to put in to make 100 megawatts. You build the building, you finance it, train all these installers to put it in the right homes, 50% of them have Owens Corning insulation. There's really a huge ripple effect. But what has happened is the worldwide economic crisis has stalled growth. There isn't money available, and I think Steve's presentation is one of the best I've heard on this subject. There, and Mike or somebody this morning said there would be a lot of capacity generated within a year. Let me tell you right now, there is over 1 gigawatt of photovoltaic materials in inventory sitting in warehouses, whereas 6 months ago you had to sign up to get it, give your firstborn child. Now it's gone the other way. And solar manufacturers are laying people off. I hadn't heard anybody say that this morning, but if you read the releases, that's what's going on. So the industry is stagnant. So what's needed? And hopefully this is large enough that people in the back can read it. And being a 13th speaker, you may have heard this before. We need market pool. We need funded solar projects. And I can't figure out how to do that. I really liked Steve's presentation. It just seems to me, in my simple-minded sitting in Toledo, Ohio, watching the sun shine down, that somebody is handing out billions of dollars to companies that are never going to make it. General Motors is a mess. Chrysler is a mess. I was one of their 10th largest supplier at one time. They've gone downhill. They're never going to come back. We're giving a lot of money to states that I don't think they're going to know what to do with it. Their idea of energy is, let's give everybody a carton of compact fluorescent bulbs. We need some sort of an energy policy that does something. And if you want to put people to work, you look at the kind of people that are out of work, they're automotive workers and or suppliers, and God knows they can be retrained, or they're construction people, and they don't need a lot of training. What I think we need, when we had the last Great Depression, and I certainly heard a lot about that from my mother, was as a green conservation corps. You have all these people that are out of work. We have a gigawatt in the warehouse. Why don't we spend some of this incentive money, train these people in 2 weeks, that's about what it takes, and within 2 months we could have tens of thousands of people putting in product that's already there. And the gentleman that suggested it should be made in the U.S. is right. The field we put in Toledo, Ohio was 93% produced in Ohio. The only thing we didn't have was an inverter company. And if you put in a lot of things, you know there aren't very many of those in the U.S. Well, we went and started one. So we went to see the governor of Ohio a couple of weeks ago. He wouldn't see us. We saw his energy czar. And we said, well, geez, why don't you do this in Ohio? You put in a mile and a half square in 2 years. We can get all the stuff. Use brownfields. Eastern United States and the Midwest is the brownfield capital. I mean, look at all the stuff that's shut down. There are 830 acres in Toledo of loam, of things that are probably paved and have power lines going over them. And you don't want to dig there. I mean, I worked for Union Carbide. You know, you don't want to spend a lot of time there. You start to glow at night. So look at what we would use. This is all stuff that you had in the automotive industry. 56 million square feet of glass, a lot of windshields, 18 million feet. And I think with this kind of scale, you would be getting less expensive electricity. Certainly a lot less expensive than it's going to be in 15 years. So the idea of funding this up front is a good one. So use some of the Recovery Act dollars to build it. What else are they going to do with this money? Squander it? School solar projects will also qualify for the funding, and we are working, Ohio Advanced Energy is working to have a school solar thing. It's, what is it, House Bill 113, something like that. We could put all Ohio content in there. You can, as Steve has suggested, sell or lease to lower or reclaim the cost. RECs to utilities, fields to utilities, municipalities, private investors who can use the grants and tax credits, and get some support. This ODOD is Ohio Department of Development. What we have done in Toledo is put together this group of companies that can build solar farms. The only one we've put in is the one that Marcy Kaptur helped us get. So here we got First Solar, Sunlight, Calixto, Willard and Kelsey. Glass from Pilkington is located in Toledo. PVAC, land reclamation, contracting. This guy used to make automotive things and things for Wells. He started up this and so on. And here's Nextronics, the inverter company. So we built it, and they haven't come. So our field of solar dreams and I just thought of that, actually. It's good to be sitting here for a while with y'all. Our field of solar dreams is sort of coming down. So you go around and say, if you're going to hand out billions to the fuse industry that have been sucking tailpipes for 10 years, why don't you pick one that has a bright future and do something with it and help out the people in this room? So all you government people that are here, or did they all leave because there was something more important? That's my message. Thank you.
I'm sure that there are a few questions stimulated by this panel. And Chuck, we have time for a few, don't we?
Yes, not only time,
good.
But encouragement, because the Congresswoman is at 14th Street.
Oh, okay.
So in 35 minutes.
Yeah.
No. So quite seriously, we would ask you all to stay here and ask some questions, and she'll come in and give her
good.
Her talk.
Thank you. And I might take the liberty of asking one of the first questions, because I'm sure Norm's going to be very interested about this. And it's for Steve. Based on the market opportunity and the market risk and a $140 billion gap and a 20-year return, at what stage does Deutsche Bank see that they would be willing to invest in a company, and what stage that company have to be before you'd be willing to take a risk in it?
First thing I will say is I can't speak directly for Deutsche Bank, but what I will say is the following. What's going on right now is a bit of a problem, to say the least. It's not about returns and banks not finding good investments. It's about balance sheets of banks across the globe. The problem is not that banks don't want to lend. The problem is that you have compositions of balance sheets that need to be completely revamped. I don't pretend to understand the complexity of a big bank balance sheet. It's mind-bogglingly complex, and there's all kinds of assets on it. What started last November, arguably September-October timeframe, with the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers, was that all the banks started looking at all of their assets on the balance sheets, and they started to do this process called de-risking. What that means is you go through everything you have on your balance sheet, you either get rid of it, you rationalize it, and you reconstitute your balance sheet so that it has the right risk profile and the right leverage. Now, that's a long process. And my guess is it's going to take a while before that process is done. So it's not that a Deutsche Bank or any other bank doesn't want to lend or doesn't see value in a return on a renewable energy project, because they're very safe investments for the most part. It's that until bank balance sheets are reconstituted, there will be no lending. It's as simple as that. Now that's a bit harshly said, but I think that's the situation we're really in.
So that's why you're suggesting government incentives, both at the federal and at the state level, as well as tax incentives.
On the manufacturing side, it seems the biggest issue we have to overcome is taxes. Now, the playing field is not level. And it's entirely possible that even if there are tax incentives to bring manufacturing to the U.S., you will find another country in Asia that's willing to forego taxes for 15 years in order to bring industry. Now, that's something that's going to happen whether we like it or not. I think one of the ways around that is some incentives up front that maybe don't constitute a recoupment of everything that you would lose in profitability, but growing a market here. We have a choice here whether we have a stagnant market, a growing market, or a rapidly growing market. The best solution to all of this is to somehow get to that rapidly growing market.
Other questions from the audience?
Can I make a comment on that?
Yes, you may, Norm.
Having been involved...
I think you're going to anyway, aren't you?
Having been involved with some European companies and being on their board, I know when they started looking for locations, they were approached by probably 75 countries and made some extremely attractive offers to them. And many of them included flat-out no taxes for a long period of time, just as Steve has said. The interesting thing, though, is when you're shipping glass all over the world, and I worked for a glass company for a number of years, there comes a time when there's a balance. If you have to get it to your market, there's a time when there's a balance. And I think Dick said this. He's tired of shipping glass from the U.S. to here to there and back again. Once fuel costs go back up, that's going to be a more important thing. So I just flat out cannot think of anything more important than having a local market for your product with the technical talent we have in the U.S. to start it up, because they're having a hard time finding technical talent in places that don't have taxes.
I think you've got a model program done in Northeast. It's very complimentary to see all of the partners you brought together and that type of.
Well, thank you. And when Marcy gets here, you can thank her as well.
Chuck?
Well, just so we know what to ask Marcy for, you know, you should never see a congressperson without knowing what to ask them. What would it take, in your view, and why don't we cross-check that with the other two members of the panel, if we were to make a demonstration project out of it, because I wouldn't want to give money to someone, but a demonstration project where we gave money to where you want it to go would probably be acceptable. What would that cost, and what metrics would you use?
Well, she came up with over $5 million for an Air Force base that has a 3.4 megawatt usage, and we put in 1 megawatt of product for under $4 installed cost. So she's going ahead with helping on that. We jokingly call it Marcy's megawatt, I mean, to her face. She's very, very proud of this and has a long-term record in doing this. I would like to see her, instead of using her influence to help Northwest Ohio, I'd like to see her use her influence to help the United States and help get some of this incentive money in every state, in every congressional area where everybody's sitting here, to do the same kind of projects with this Green Conservation Corps. We look at bridges and hotels that were built in the 30s, and everybody says, wow. Well, it'd be nice to look at 30 years from now at solar fields, and we're still getting power from, and say, wow.
Well, I'm not sure where I'll look at it 30 years from now, but the but the question I was asking a serious question about the demonstration model. That type of productive imitation is useful. Perhaps Professor Zweibel would handle this. What do you think we would need to put in? Is it feasible to put in a large-scale demonstration model?
But first of all, I want to reiterate that the next dollar that's best spent photovoltaics, dollar that leverages technology leadership, that the technology leadership in the United States, SunPower, U.S. Solar, and First Solar, should convince somebody of something, that R&D money and technology development rational way lead to leadership. And that is right now, as far as we can tell in this room, the only thing the United States has that it can depend on. Anything else we have to figure out something about, like trying to beat somebody else at tax issues. And I appreciate that, and I think that's very worthwhile. But we should not forget that we have literally no R&D program in photovoltaics right now in the United States in terms of the kind of leverage we need to move this technology forward. And I want to make it very clear, I'm talking about crystalline silicon, amorphous silicon, thin film microcrystalline silicon, cadmium telluride, and copper-neodymium diselenide. I'm not talking about plastic solar cells, not talking about fifth-generation solar cells that are in people's proposals from single professors at various universities around the United States that are playing with beakers. I'm talking about stuff that is out there in gigawatts that has an opportunity to be half today's cost and lower than that, and that can meet needs in a cost-effective way so that all these problems are much less difficult in terms of meeting those financial structured items that Steve showed you.
So how much money would be required and for what period of time?
Well, you know, we have the money in a sense. We need the sense to use it properly.
And you say we have the money. Where is the money? It just walked in the room. Okay. You're talking about Marcy dollars, right? Hi. Norman one.
Oh, no.
By the way, I've known Marcy for 25 years, and she's introduced me in Toledo about 5 times, and I've said the Rust Belt would be the future of photovoltaics during that whole time. Turned out to be true.
Well, Ken, I think you can take the introduction for this one, then. I don't think we need that with really any to-do. We've been talking about your accomplishments and contributions to the Toledo solar cluster for the last hour. And Norm has been more than complimentary in a number of statements, and we would just welcome your observations on what we can do to further advance the industry here. By here we mean both in the United States. But we're also talking about perhaps the need to focus it in particular clusters as a way of demonstrating to the rest of the country what can be done. And we're again very grateful. Could we have a welcoming round of applause here for the Congressman?
Thank you very much. Will I ruin everything if I put this laptop, if I close the top or not? All right, very good. Well, first of all, thank you very much. I guess you've been here all day. Is that true? And you look pretty wide awake to me. And so we give you a big Buckeye afternoon welcome. We have our legislative director, Deborah Kuhlbeck, who is a friend of the Academy right here, and also from our D.C. office on our legislative staff. Deborah heads the legislative staff. Matt Kaplan, I see him down here, right toward the front, and he's involved in many aspects of bioenergy and of new energy for our country, and staffs us out in many areas, including in agriculture, where we wrote the first title to a farm bill in history on the Appropriations Committee for energy, as we gave that focus to a department that had to be dragged into the 21st century. So I'm really happy that Matt is here as well. I want to thank the National Academies and Dr. Westner in particular for allowing us to spend a few moments with you today. This is a very important gathering, and I'm so proud of all those who have come from the Academy and from our region to discuss the future of photovoltaic manufacturing in the United States. It is really an honor to speak on a subject that promotes economic and environmental sustainability and energy independence for our nation, which is my top priority as a member of the Defense Committee. Now, I'm sure you've heard a great deal, and there are probably individuals here from our university. I think I see Dr. Deng. Is that hello, doctor? I am at once with my community, both those who currently reside there, those who have resided there, those who were there when I was a child growing up and gave me direction, and those who will be there after me. I am very proud of where I come from. And you might be asking, how in the world did Toledo, Ohio, the home of Danny Thomas, get involved in the advanced manufacturing of photovoltaics, leading our nation and globe toward an energy-independent future? And it's a good question. First of all, immediately, all across our region of Ohio, from Toledo along Lake Erie's south coast all the way to Cleveland, power rates that are charged by our current investor-owned utilities are among the most expensive in our nation. I just finished talking with Ed Markey. I said, if you're going to cram down a cap-and-trade solution for this country, my price as a member of Congress is a federal power station for our region. And I said, why should you ask us to compete with the TVA in Bonneville when we have nothing? And we are investor-owned, and we have a better idea. So that's a little bit what I talk about in the Congress in quiet conversations during the afternoon. These high utility rates are among the most serious impediments to economic growth in our region. It is amazing that we have the industry and business that we have in view of these incredible prices. It shows you people really do want to live there. It is beautiful, and it is sustainable. And yet we have this albatross of such high utility rates and very poorly managed companies. I also represent the worst nuclear power plant in the United States of America. Now, with two incidents, one per decade has been averaging in my career, that is one too many and two too many. Unlike regions that have subsidized power through federal power marketing authorities like Bonneville or even the Tennessee Valley Authority, we must reinvent our power future, drawing on our natural assets in order to be competitive in the global marketplace. And unlike Washington, D.C., we have no cushions. You are in a capital city. If you're in Washington, if you're in Columbus, Ohio, where the top 10 employers are government, you don't understand what I'm talking about. We come from the free market part of America. We have to grow and build wealth. I am very resentful that New York, Wall Street, has traded that wealth away, and Charlotte. And they've hurt us a great deal. But we know what we have to do in order to build our future and, in turn, America's future. And as one of my wonderful political friends used to chide voters each election day, vote. Save yourself. Vote. Save yourself. And what we're doing is saving ourselves through inventing our energy future. Secondly, another reason our region of Ohio has built a reputation as a leader in new energy technologies through building on our innate natural strengths is that Toledo historically has been known as the glass capital of the world. You may know some of these names. Libby owns Ford. Our dad and mom used to have a little market, supermarket across the street, family market across the street. 5,000 people used to work at Libby Owens Ford in our region, no more. But they've been succeeded by Pilkington, which has Pilkington Fire Glass, which I commend to any of you. An incredible product. We have Johns Manville Fiberglass. You look at the companies, Owens Illinois, Libby Glass, and we'll talk about some of the solar companies that are being birthed now. But we have an historic, century-long set of investments that are rooted in our silicate and lime assets, as well as the physics of glass that was pursued more robustly post-World War II through great business leaders in our community like John Biggers, where we used to have wavy glass. Maybe some of you remember that. And now when you look through your car window, it's, you can actually see without the wavy stuff, your house too. But back even during World War II, we really didn't understand the physics of glass. And we've been pushing at the edges of all of those for a century. And in so doing, we have helped to develop new opportunity in solar energy, including solar energy building materials, heat shields, new types of fiber optics, and so much more, continuing to invest in the science and pushing the science to do new things for the world. It is hard to pinpoint exactly when my work in this renewable energy sector began. As a White House policy advisor to then President Jimmy Carter, I actually lived the oil embargo of the late 1970s. And I saw, some of you might have been alive in those days too, and you saw what it did to our country. It was the first slap in the face, really hard slap in the face, that really knocked our teeth out back in the late 1970s. And we had a president who wisely in those days said what we had then endured, the Republic endured, was the moral equivalent of war. And he remains right to this day. But the nation forgot his message. They forgot his message. And as a young congresswoman, by an act of God, I happened to get elected in the early 1980s. And I ran for office. This isn't my first profession. My first profession is a city and regional planner, which I practiced for almost 2 decades before ever running for this job. This is a whole different place. But I was always interested in sustainability at the neighborhood level, at the community level, and building on natural assets. And in the 80s, when the economy turned as sour as we have today, coming out of that Arab oil embargo, the unemployment in my region was higher than I had ever seen it. And I thought, here I am as a professional person, and I'm meeting people that I grew up with in my community who are hard up against the wall. I have to be their voice. And that's what motivated me to run in the first place. And starting back in the 1980s as a member of Congress, those were the Reagan years, if you look at the budgets of the U.S. government in the National Science Foundation and many of our Department of Energy, you will see that photovoltaic research and alternative energy was substantially diminished. How many of you lived through that? I lived through that. But if you look at my congressional record, going back to the 1980s, in every account where we could make a difference, I tried to make a difference at the National Science Foundation, at NASA, looking at the basic research that we could do. I wasn't so powerful on defense in those days, but I'm into that now, and they got a whole new mission. And we kept pushing photovoltaics. I'm just going to use this sector because we've pushed on many fronts, biofuels and cryogenic hydrogen, and there's many other areas, but let's just focus on the solar for this afternoon. And I met so many magnificent Americans along the way. One of those gentlemen, and I know he was a very close friend of Norm Johnson, who's here today, was Dr. Harold McMaster. And Dr. McMaster, now I believe he was a Republican. I don't know. I never really asked him. But he and his partner, Mr. Norm Nitschke, and here I was a woman member. I mean, you got to go back to the 1980s. There are only 24 of us that walk these halls. So even to deal with a woman in those days was sort of weird. If you were particularly a businessman from the Midwest, you know, and here you're a Republican and she's a Democrat, how do you even talk to her? And yet Dr. McMaster invited me out. And he founded the company called First Solar, and I know you heard from Mike Ahern a little bit earlier today, didn't you? And he took me to a lab out at our university, which in those days was not among the top 20 research engineering schools at the graduate level in the country. It is today. And he said, I want to show you something. And he showed me this contraption that I didn't know what I was looking at, but reduced to its simplest, it was a vacuum chamber. And he was about the task of building some of the first chips for First Solar. And I really liked him. And then I watched the companies he founded, and they all made money. And I remember when Honda gave him the worst, and Norm, I don't know if you were involved with him in those days, the worst window, the back of the window of this thing, had all these angles, and Honda said, you'll never be able to build it. I was there the day when the first rear window came off, it didn't crack, and they all came off the line. I said, right, you know, they can do it here. And so I watched this incredible gentleman and all of his friends and how much they loved our community, great philanthropists. They weren't like these boys that have taken us down now on Wall Street. These were men who loved where they came from. They invested in our local school systems. They gave millions of dollars to our university. They knew what it was built to build a community and build a country. They respected one another, and they knew that they had to move America forward. And so I feel so privileged to have had them among my friends. And I can remember their boundless vision to produce a new generation of research and innovation for our country. And they were both scientists and entrepreneurs at the same time. I meet so few of those. You either meet greedy business people and not too many philanthropists, or you meet scientists who are incredible, but they can never tell you exactly what they're going to do with this stuff that they're working on and what relevance to life it has. But I actually have had the privilege of meeting people who can bridge that divide. And it's just so exciting. And they never quit. They never quit innovating. I can remember my last conversation, Norm's heard me tell this story before, with Dr. McMaster. He was about 85 years old. And we were out at the Montessori school, which he helped to fund in our region. He was in a wheelchair. And he said, Congresswoman, I want you to come into my office. And I got my son here and my wife and a couple other people. And that was it. And he closed the door. And he said, now, and he looked right at his sons. He goes, I don't care if you join me or not, but I'm going to found a new company. And the company's called Solar Fields. And here's what it's going to do. We are going to build a solar field 50 miles by 50 miles, 50 miles wide by 50 miles long. And I'm sitting there thinking in my district going, that's pretty big. and he said, so if you want to help me, okay. If you don't, okay. Well, there I am as a federal official, right? And I, well, Dr. McMaster, I said, if this is a prototype project, can you make it a little smaller? I said, I don't think that I can get any federal help at this point for something that big. I said, could I ask you, where is this going to be? And he said, I said, do you know where it's going to be? He goes, oh, yes. He said, I'm going to put it in a place where the sun meets the earth at a certain angle and where there is no dust. I said, so where would that be? Hoping he would say Lake Erie. And he said, the Salton Sea. He'd already figured it out. And I said, okay, so doctor, so when we get this built, then what are we going to do? He said, we're going to backload the United States. Now, you may not agree with a single field, but imagine knowing a person like that. He had a vision. And whether it was exactly like that or not, who couldn't be inspired with that? I walked out of that meeting and I felt just like, oh my, I've got the Holy Grail. And I got to carry it. And I've been about that. And that's really what I feel I have been about. Other men that preceded him, like John Biggers, that I had known in my own life, who worked at another company in Toledo, a businessman, his wife, they loved our community. They treated their workers with respect. They made very good products at that company. They lived and died in our community. They didn't want anything else but to do something great for America and to be kind to the people who lived around them. That's the kind of place that I want to live. Finally, let me do a little bit to brag about our modern-day successors and to say that I'm so happy that they are getting some of the publicity that they deserve for all of the effort that they have put forward when America was asleep and there were dark solar moments in our country. And our region's photovoltaic industry has now been featured, as I'm sure you've been told, on everything from CNN to ABC News to the Wall Street Journal to Newsweek. And then in 2007, Toledo was featured in The Economist magazine as one of the six places on Earth with real strength in new solar power systems and one of only three in this hemisphere. But it isn't by accident. It's because we know who we are and because many people over several generations gave their lives to it and still give their lives to it. Our state of Ohio has just recognized our two-decade-long effort in this new era in pursuing innovation and research and development through the federal government, using the resources of the Department of Defense, NASA, NSF, and the Department of Energy, by Ohio now investing in what's called the Wright Center for Photovoltaics Innovation and Commercialization at the University of Toledo. So we even woke up Ohio. And I've always said the further south you go, the more bleak it gets. But, you know, we find now those people down there in the Capitol finally sort of woke up and looked north. And without question, our University of Toledo is charging ahead in this new energy area. The recent World Energy Conference in Abu Dhabi, did anybody go? What's interesting about that, there were only two universities in the United States that attended. You'd expect MIT to be there, right? The other one was the University of Toledo. I'm very proud about that. We know that new energy systems are essential to securing our economic, environmental, and energy independence. And I just want to remind you of some brutal figures. Just in 2006, and it didn't get any better last year, a third of our U.S. trade deficit, which now approaches three-quarters of a trillion dollars, between $800 and $900 billion a year, is from imported oil. This is a national security interest of this country. It is the primary national security interest. One-third of our imbalance in the trade sector due to imported energy. And look what it is doing to us. It has turned us inside out. We are not independent as a country. Our addiction to imported fuel is obvious, and the solution seems just as clear. Develop a comprehensive plan to use our domestic resources. We are about that full bore in our region. Recapture that $836 billion in lost wealth every year back here at home. What a boon that would be to our economy. From domestically produced biofuels, wind production, where Lake Erie is the Saudi Arabia of wind, to this solar sector, geothermal, cryogenic hydrogen, wave power, and fuel cells, the potential of these new markets are unlimited and only limited by our technological and industrial imagination. With half as many sunny days as Portugal, the world's leading solar energy producer now is not us, but Germany. Germany now accounts for 15% of worldwide sales in solar panels and other photovoltaic equipment. It has 15 of the 20 largest solar plants on Earth. That's right, a country located in Northern Europe without as many sunny days as Toledo, with no natural advantage. It is outperforming the rest of the world because it sees the future. Let us compare our public commitment to solar energy to that of nuclear. While today nuclear is commonly used and generates large portions of our electricity, this didn't happen by accident. It took a concentrated and deliberate approach to broaden our electrical usage through that mode. And between 1943 and 1999, the nuclear industry received over $145 billion in federal subsidies. Those are the ones they're willing to admit, not counting all the tax subsidies, versus $4.4 billion for solar. $145 billion versus a little over $4 billion. And $1.3 billion in wind energy. We haven't even begun to fight. The fiscal cost of our continued dependence on oil can be measured in many ways. This year, our nation will spend over $600 billion on our nation's defense, the largest amount in U.S. history. And as General David Petraeus testified yesterday in closed session before our Defense Committee, this is what he said about CENTCOM, which is the part of our defense establishment that is an umbrella over the Middle East. He said, CENTCOM encompasses the world's most energy-rich region, with the Arabian Gulf region and Central Asia together accounting for at least 64% of the world's petroleum reserves, 34% of its crude oil production, and 46% of its natural resources. And for each of you, as citizens of this republic, you have to ask, is this the world you want for your children? And if it is, then we don't have to change. But I'll tell you what, I'd sure like to bring all our Buckeye soldiers home from Iraq, and it breaks my heart to have to wish off units or to greet caskets when they roll off the airplanes at our tarmac, and then to care for wounded veterans who aren't getting the care that they need. And after you've done that enough times, your opinion might change. In addition to a stable, long-term funding source focused on basic energy research, which I fully support and have supported, we must also devote significant resources to commercialization of these technologies, and I know there are many firms and researchers who are interested in that. Unlike nuclear or other large-scale power production models, the potential for solar technologies are evident in all sectors of our economy, from personal, residential, vehicle, or business uses. The commercialization of this technology is key to transforming our economy and converting technologies from the laboratory to the consumer. But I can't tell you how hard this is to do locally. I have this idea of, you know, where do you start? If you have good products, which we do, one of the efforts we've made locally is to take the first National Guard base in our country and to solar power it up. It will produce 1 megawatt. It is a research base, and every single row of panels that is installed, I'm told by the researchers, the next row is more efficient than the last row. We're going to keep pushing the science. And the head of the base said to me, Colonel Bartman, he said, Congresswoman, I have a question to ask you. He said, when we produce this excess power, the utility pays us 3 cents if we give them the excess. But how come they charge us 9 cents when we have to buy from them? I said, that is a key question, Colonel. And so we think about how to deploy this technology for independence. In my neighborhood, where I live, they just dug a huge 5-mile swath to put through a 7-foot sewer main for stormwater. And I said to the city engineer, you know, I got an idea. We got all these smart professors out there at the university and all these solar companies. What if we got stakeholders along the way to agree to allow in that same hole a power corridor where we could put up installations and local business, local residents that one could tap into a new grid, that we would invest in ourselves, use the bonding power of our city through its utilities department, put up these installations and allow us to pay it back over 25 years. And the head of utilities said to me, well, I wasn't trained to do that. I'm a water and sewer guy. I said, well, you know how to dig holes. And I said, you've got assets at your fingertips. And you know, you have to change thinking inside out to think about the power that we are abdicating every day, because we have to retrain a whole new generation how to live in a new energy age and how to use our resources efficiently. One of the reasons that Toledo has been so successful in spinning off solar technologies is because we have created a close partnership between our universities, industry, and government. They're all working together. Partisanship doesn't matter. Science matters. Business matters. Energy independence matters. We have sustained our commitment to basic research, sustained our commitment. As a prerequisite to the development of successful solar companies capable of transforming that research into practice. And we will never stop pushing the science. We know how important that is. At the University of Toledo, the two most obvious vehicles of success have been the University of Toledo's Clean and Alternative Energy Incubator and the university's Clean Energy Alliance of Ohio, which is based in Toledo. Both of these entities exist for the sole purpose of taking basic research and attracting private interest in the technologies the universities are producing. The university's Dr. Al Campan and Robert Collins, I don't know if you've met them, have joined us at many points along the way as pioneers in a new century, standing on the shoulders of those who bequeathed to us our great glass heritage. Luckily, Washington is arising from its slumber. Our new president, Barack Obama, recognizes that long-term commitments to basic research are needed. The recovery package represents the first step and the single largest legislative commitment to alternative energy. As we speak, the Energy and Commerce Committee is debating climate change legislation. I just talked to Ed Markey a little bit earlier, that would incentivize alternative energy for our electricity grid and promote alternative energy technologies. Yet what we seem to be missing from the national debate is concerted, regionalized, federal efforts to transform the science into commercial technologies. Communities like Toledo have the infrastructure, expertise, and desire. What they need is a concerted federal commitment to transform, to continue transforming those technologies from the lab to the factory floor. In the early 1990s, our grandparents and parents were a part, in the early 1900s, our grandparents and parents were a part of the Industrial Revolution that secured our family's livelihoods for generations. We made things. We invented. We made a lot of things, and we made them very, very well. A similar opportunity is before us today as we move into the renewable energy age and the sustainable age. It's hard to think about the fact that today we have 300 million people in this country. When I was born, there were 146 million. That dates me. But by 2050, they anticipate our country will have over 500 million people. How are we going to sustain this country? How will we be a partner in the world for a sustainable Earth? Part of the answer has to be powered by renewable energy, capitalizing on the historic strengths of places like Toledo, and creating multiple opportunities for our future. But we all have to see, or at least the majority of us have to see, that same future and possibility. Everything we need in the Toledo area is right in our backyard, including the sun. Even the symbol of the city of Toledo, which reads, "To work and to pray," has a rising sun. It's perfect. I wish I could hand it out to you today. It is our turn now to give back in memory of our forebears by building forward to future generations, and our region believes we know we are doing exactly that. And we appreciate that the nation and the world are buying from us. I thank you for the opportunity to join you today, and it's such a pleasure to see some of our dear friends here in the crowd, and I hope to be able to stay and listen for a while to hear their presentations as well, and I thank you for the opportunity to share a few thoughts with you today. Thank you very much. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. We have an opportunity here for perhaps a few questions. Just, Congresswoman, would you care to accept that opportunity?
Everyone up here. I haven't heard what they're all saying.
Probably a growing pressing need for a break here, but perhaps, are there any, anyone like to ask a question? And if not, we'll break for, please.
Well,
there's the mic, please.
Hi, my name's John Gardiner, and I'm not involved in photovoltaics at all, but I'm a great fan of technology and innovation, which is why I follow the STEP program. We heard this afternoon from the third panel about the necessity for huge collaborations in order to get this technology not only moving forward faster and more reliably, but also in a sustainable and growing manner. And they suggested to us that models, at least, if not some of the actual collaborative programs, are already in place. What I haven't heard so far is any response from the people who are currently involved in solar development as to whether or not they accept the need for something as vast as those collaborations, and whether or not they have considered or would consider joining such collaborations. Would you please comment?
Back when I was in the solar program at NREL, we had collaborations called the National Research Teams. And some of those people are actually in the room today. In fact, about 10 of them, which I'm really totally shocked. And essentially what we did was, based on technology, we would have people from all over the country, like the University of Toledo, Colorado School of Mine, and University of Toledo, companies get together and work on collaboratively on projects, and then go back and work for another 6 months and come back to another meeting. And so we had some continuity of that. I think that collaborations are great, but I think you should always start simple. So the simple step is to know what you need to do. Foundational understanding of semiconductors, to do solar cells, to improve solar cells, improve processes, and to do that iteratively on a large number of samples to get a better and better technology. Once you have that in place, then you can build on that and to go to the next level of collaborations. Start simple, do the simple foundational things, and move on.
Congresswoman Kaptur, thank you so much for your stimulating words, as usual, and thank you for your consistent and enthusiastic support for photovoltaics over many years. One of the things that we've been talking about here this morning and this afternoon are the challenges presented by East Asia and other countries that are offering huge incentives, free land and tax credits and so on, and the question of leveling the playing field. And some of the things that have been discussed are Buy America provisions or other kinds of things that can help to level the playing field. And I'm just wondering what sort of discussions are underway in Congress about those kinds of issues.
Doctor, thank you very much for your incredible work. Dr. Kampan lives in a solar house, and he drives a truck with six batteries in the back bed, is that right? Takes it home every night, plugs it in the wall, and drives it back to the university in the morning. This is a man who lives what he believes. I think he was responsible for solar installations at his church in Sylvania, Ohio, and I respect him very, very much. And he is in the tradition of those who have built a new America. So proud to know you, Doctor. As far as U.S. production, this mic, I hope it's working. I worry about that a lot. And it gets into the whole area of, is our trade policy fair? Is our tax policy fair to any business, including businesses involved in renewable energy? And I have to say to you, no, they are not. Because of the value-added tax and the severe penalty that I think I'm going to talk up here because there's something wrong with this. The value-added tax and the severe disadvantage to U.S. business in the global marketplace is something that troubles me a lot, and it will affect this industry. Trade laws that keep out our product. Take autos. Japan has less than 3% of the cars on its streets from any place in the world. Over half the stuff that rolls around out here is from other places or from companies from other countries manufacturing in our country. We're the most open market. In fact, we're the dump market of the world. And therefore, you say to yourself, with a tax law that doesn't help you, with a trade law that doesn't help you, what do you do? One of my brilliant friends made a suggestion to me, and I'd be very interested to hear your reaction to this, even though patent laws are changing a lot. Said, Marcy, why don't you figure out a way, and it's GATT legal, that if the federal government has money invested in a new technology, that we somehow extend the patent term to allow that production to occur in the United States is one of the incentives that we can offer, knowing that tax law works against us, trade law works against us. And one of the questions I would ask those who are involved in innovation here is look at the patent laws of our country and under the GATT and WTO, I think that is one of the most interesting suggestions I have ever gotten. How would we extend it to be valuable to business that invests in the United States? That would be a regulatory change that we could make. It would probably be fairly simple to pass, and one that would secure investment here, because I'll tell you, it troubles me as is that the citizens in my district, we now have 14 to 20% unemployment in the counties that I represent. Think about that. And we're trying to birth new industry to help us build the future. And you can have a company that can come and take all your innovation and move it somewhere else where people work for slave wages. Why should I, as a congresswoman, I say, my biggest worry is somebody's going to walk off with 100 years of effort, who won't love our community like Dr. Compan, who won't love our community like Dr. McMaster, who won't love our community like Norm Johnson. And it almost seems unpatriotic to me. It almost seems un-American to me that we would use the tax dollars of our people to birth new technology and then they wouldn't benefit. And I think to myself, you know, those boys on Wall Street, they do things I don't like. And they have hurt. I'll just give you an example. Because they trade in our wealth. They trade in what we make, and I don't like it. Because they trade us away in the blink of an eye. Blink of an eye. I had a meeting the other day in my district relating to businesses not being able to get credit. We had over 400. We thought we'd have 50, 100 businesses show up. 400 businesses showed up. And the Small Business Administration had invited all the banks to participate. Not a single bank that got TARP funds showed up. You know who showed up? The credit unions, Genoa Bank, you won't know these names, First Federal Bank, Maumee Bank, our community banks. And I said, oh, Wall Street, you're shouting at me again. You're shouting by not being here. And you have hurt my people. And I hate you for it. I hate you for it. And so these are the same forces that will work to outsource production. They don't care about Toledo. They make fun of places like Toledo because we eat hot dogs and drink beer. And we like where we live. We're tough. And we like to build our way forward, but we don't like to be mistreated. And we feel like we're being mistreated. So I wish I could fix the VAT tax. I talk about it all the time. I wish I could change our trade laws. I just finished a debate in Congress on that today with some of my colleagues. But on the patent extension, I wonder if there isn't something we could do there. And I am more than open to ideas. I support all Buy American provisions. I just put a bill in this week that if they sell anything in the gift shop in the Congress of the United States, it's got to be made in the Congress. It's got to be made in the United States, okay? I say, oh, she's a flat worlder. You know, there's something wrong with her. But to support that, but I really believe that. I think it's wrong that people in my district who have a very hard work ethic, that 20% of them are out of work. They don't deserve that. They don't deserve that. So I favor incentives to hold investment here. I favor giving incentives to capital that invests in these industries, but I want to hold that investment here so long as, you know, it's competitive and, you know, all the rest of it. But I don't like the idea of technology being stolen and placed elsewhere. That really bothers me a lot. So I'm always open to ideas there. You let me know what you think about the patent extension. Yes, sir.
Well, Congresswoman, I'm happy to tell you on behalf of the STEP board that we are doing work on patent reform. We're also, thanks to the support of the Department of Energy and NIST, working on how we can push this industry forward and what are the practical steps. But speaking of practical steps, I've learned over the years that after about an hour and a half, at least half the meeting needs to get up and move. So I think what I'd like to do is let people approach you individually. And could I ask you all to be back here in 10 minutes? We've had a little shift in our schedule, so I'd be grateful if we could be back.
Let's thank the panel that just completed this session.